Last week I spoke of the importance of place in the work of the poet Wallace Stevens. There's another poet for whom place is absolutely paramount, and that's the poet I'd like to speak of this week, Robinson Jeffers. Robinson Jeffers, his place, his living space, being the California coast in the region of Carmel. Stevens spoke also of the poem of the earth. The poem of the earth as contrasted to the poem of heaven and the poem of hell, which he said had already been written. Think of Dante, for example. What remained to be written, according to Wallace Stevens, was the poem of the earth. And this is very much what we find in Robinson Jeffers. It's very much an earth poetry, an earth ocean poetry, which we find in this man's work. An earth ocean poetry with long, rugged, Pacific rolling lines and a clear sounding language. Listen to what he says in this poem, Return. A return to the earth, in fact, away from all too human preoccupations. A little too abstract, a little too wise. It is time for us to kiss the earth again. It is time to let the leaves rain from the skies. Let the rich life run to the roots again. I will go down to the lovely sore rivers and deep my arms in them up to the shoulders. I will find my accounting where the alder leaf quivers in the ocean wind over the river boulders. I will touch things and things and no more thoughts that breed like mouthless mayflies darkening the sky. The insect clouds that blind our passionate hawks so that they cannot strike, hardly can fly. Things are the hawk's food, and noble is the mountain. Oh, noble Pico Blanco, steep sea wave of marble. Pico Blanco is the mountain of that district, Pico Blanco, Spanish, the White Peak. There's a leitmotif in this poem which comes up again and again. We found it already in William Carlos Williams. This idea of no ideas but in things. I will touch things and things and no more thoughts. The idea of getting away from too much discourse in order to retrieve, in order to return to a sharpness of perception, a sharpness of living. Another idea you have in the poem, it is time to let the leaves rain from the skies. It's time to build up a new humus. The word humanity, in fact, almost has the word humus in it. Let's get some humus into humanity. Let's immerse ourselves in earth reality. This may lead to another kind of thought, but for the moment, let's try and get out of too much discursive thought. Let's try and get in touch again. I will touch things and no more thoughts. As we saw in William Carlos Williams, no ideas but in things. Robinson Jeffers was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 1887. His father, who was of Scottish origins, held the chair of Old Testament literature and exegesis at the Western Theological Seminary. There's a biblical background there. The family background was Calvinistic. And without going into long definitions of Calvinism, let's say that this tended to mean a certain austerity of living. It was Calvinistic, but not over harshly Calvinistic. The ambience was intelligent and widely cultured. But there is this austerity in the background, an austerity and a severity, vis-à-vis, let's say, oneself. 1899-1902, he's traveling in Europe. It's a rather, you know, fairly well-to-do family, so Europe traveling was possible. And even foreign schooling was possible. The young Jeffers schooled in Switzerland and in Germany. And he was known among the teachers, it's anecdotal but it's significant, as the little Spartan, even as a youngster. He was practicing a kind of asceticism, undergoing certain types of physical severity and endurance. He also had from early on in these schools, and thanks to private tuition from his father, a solid grounding in classics, Latin and Greek. 1903, the family moves to Pasadena, California. This is the first contact with California. And Jeffers enters Occidental College. He also spends a great deal of time, and this is important, of course, walking in the mountains. 1905, he graduates from Occidental College and undertakes graduate study at the University of Southern California, studying for an MA in literature. His subjects are, and again these are significant, oratory, this oratorical thing in American poetry, of speaking out to an audience, oratory, English, and Spanish. Spanish was going to be important, of course, for a situation on the west coast of the States where the Spanish tradition is still strong. 1905, he meets the woman he was later going to marry, Una Custer. 1907, again he's traveling in Europe, and he even intends to study at the University of Zurich. A European education was, in fact, looming on the horizon. But he does return to the States, he does return to California, and specifically to the University of Southern California, where he takes up medical studies. After literary studies, he takes up medical studies, not intending to become a doctor, with no intention of a professional career, but for the science, in order to know more about the human body, the way it works, some notions of biology and chemistry. At this time, he's also engaging in physical pursuits such as running, swimming, and wrestling. There's the kind of Greek thing, the sort of healthy mind and a healthy body thing, the classical Latin-Greek thing. During the summers, when university classes are not running, he's living out at Hermosa Beach, living out on the beach. And at this time, he decides, he says it in one of his poems, to, and here I quote, to drink wine while I can, love where I please, and feed my eyes on Santa Lucian sea beauty. Sea beauty. Feed my eyes. There's a basis in austerity, but on that basis of austerity, there's a terrific physical sensual joins. 1910, he withdraws from medical school, intending to, from now on, devote most of his thinking and existence to poetic practice. His parents moved up to Seattle, further up on the west coast, northwest coast, and he went with them. And up there on the northwest coast, in Seattle, he entered the School of Forestry of the University of Washington. Again, not intending to become, you know, a timber merchant or anything like that. He wasn't interested in timber interests. He was interested in tree knowledge, to know something real about trees. What interested him also was the outdoor physical life. 1911, he returns to California for the sake of California and because Una Custer was there. 1912, he publishes his first book, Flagons and Apples. I won't mention the titles of all of his books, I'll only mention a few, which I consider to be perhaps the most significant. 1913, after years of a difficult relationship, he marries Una Custer, and they intend to leave for Europe. They intend to settle, live, and work in Europe, turning their backs on the United States. But the year is now 1914, in other words, it's the outbreak of the war, and the Europe plan falls through. It's at that time that the couple moved to Carmel on the California coast. And we have this text by Robinson Jeffers, the August news, the news of the declaration of war, the August news turned us to this village of Carmel, and when a stagecoach topped the hill from Monterey, and we looked down through pines and sea fogs on Carmel Bay, it was evident that we had come without knowing it to our inevitable place. Our inevitable place. 1916, his second book appears, and will surprise no one if its title is Californians. Californians. And at this time, 1916, he begins to build on the California coast a house with a tower. Very much like Yeats's tower on the west coast of Ireland. 1924, an important book, Tamar and Other Poems. Tamar, T-A-M-A-R, a name you'll find in the Bible, Tamar and Other Poems. At first, this book drops like a stone. It awakens no interest whatsoever. Then, almost overnight, there is, by certain readers, an enthusiastic reception. 1925, another book, Roan Stallion, Tamar, and Other Poems. Roan Stallion, R-O-A-N, Roan Stallion. 1927, a book that caused him a lot of trouble, which was very, very coldly received, The Women at Point Sur. The Women at Point Sur. Point Sur, a place on the California coast where the Sur rivers run, the Big Sur, which was to be famous later in Henry Miller. 1928, Cawdor and Other Poems. Cawdor, C-A-W-D-O-R. 1929, another book appears, and he's travelling in England, Scotland, and Ireland. 1930, he's travelling in New Mexico, or staying in New Mexico, shall we say. 1931, the book arising from his travels in England, Scotland, Ireland. Remember, he himself was of Scottish descent through his father, and Una Custer was of Irish descent. 1931, a book written out of these travels entitled Descent to the Dead. Descent to the Dead. 1933, a book with a significant title, Give Your Heart to the Hawks. The Hawks are going to come again and again into Jeffers' poems as figures, not to say symbols, of a certain high, lonely ferocity. 1935, Solstice and Other Poems. 1937 is back in Europe. He's very much a Euro-American, if you like. 1941, a public reading tour in the US. 1948, he's back traveling in Europe. 1950, another book with a significant title, The Tower Beyond Tragedy. The Tower Beyond Tragedy. We'll speak of this idea of beyond tragedy later. And then 1954, his last important poem book, Hungerfield and Other Poems. Hungerfield, in one word. Hungerfield and Other Poems. In 1962, he dies January 20th at Carmel. Robinson Jeffers' writing stems largely, I would say, from three things. There are three basic grounds for this writing. The first is sheer contemplation of the coast. Coastal contemplation. This coast, which he was going to call the coast opposite humanity. The coast opposite humanity. So contemplation of the coast, that's one of the bases. Second basis, second ground, second source, a dramatic analysis of human pathology. A dramatic analysis written via dramatic poems, rather long dramatic poems, a dramatic analysis of human pathology. The human pathology being portrayed by certain coastal characters considered as erratic and elemental. For Jeffers, the people of the coast are elemental and erratic. They are psychologies on the edge, if you like. Psychologies on the edge physically, on the edge mentally. Wild and abrupt figures, very often female. Very often the figures on the edge there are female. Their names are symbolical. Clear Walker, one who walks clearly, or else Madroni Boswell, a name you find in the Scottish tradition, and Madroni, the tree, one of the California trees. She's rooted in this soil. So the second source is dramatic analysis of human pathology, and the third source is a vast temporal and cultural perspective, a cyclical conception of things. His perspectives are by no means limited to his own life or to his own country or to his own civilization, but he opens up a wide perspective in time and in space. And for this cyclical conception of things, let's look at the poem entitled, simply, The Cycle, which opens up wide perspectives in cultural history, beginning with an evocation of the Western landscape. The cycle. The clapping blackness of the wings of pointed cormorants, the great indolent plains of autumn pelicans, nine or a dozen strong shore long, but chiefly the gulls, the cloud calligraphers of windy spirals before a storm, cruise north and south over the sea rocks and over that bluish, enormous opal. Very lately, these alone, these and the clouds, and westering lights of heaven crossed it. But then a hull with standing canvas crept about Point Lobos. Now all day long the steamers smudge the opal's rim. Often a seaplane troubles the sea wind with its throbbing heart. These will increase, the others diminish, and later these will diminish. Our Pacific has passed your Mediterranean torch and passed it west across the fountains of the morning. And the following desolation it feeds in Crete, feed here. The clapping blackness of the wings of pointed cormorants, the great sails of autumn pelicans, the gray sea-going gulls, alone will streak the enormous opal. The earth have peace, like the broad water. Our blood's unrest have doubled to Asia and be peopling Europe again, for dropping colonies at the morning star. What moody traveler wanders back here, watches the sea fowl circle the old sea granite and cemented granite with one regard, and greets my ghost, one temper with the granite, bulking about here. So first of all, an evocation of the landscape, the first four or five lines, the gulls, the cloud calligraphers cruising along the coast, the pelicans, the cormorants. At the beginning, the coast was all alone with these figures. Then gradually, ships appeared. Standing canvas crept about Point Lobos. First of all, sailing ships, the arrival of the first colonizers on this wild, lonely coast. Then the sailing ships turned into steamers. The steamers turned into seaplanes. We have history progressing with the accumulation of technicalities. These will increase. Technology will increase. The others, the natural scene will diminish. Later, technology will fail and the natural scene will come back. It has this wide perspective, as I say, in history. Our Pacific has passed through the Mediterranean torch. He goes right back to the Mediterranean and sees the progress of civilization from the Mediterranean across the Atlantic, across the American continent, right to the Pacific. Our Pacific has passed through the Mediterranean torch and passed it west across the fountains of the morning. And the following desolation that feeds on Crete, the civilization of Crete fell into ruins. American civilization will also fall into ruins. And the coast will go back to the blackness of the wings of pointed cormorants, the sails, and the gulls. Well, the whole cycle of human migration begins again. America will have started back from Asia, will be peopling Europe, or else will be founding colonies, perhaps in interstellar space, dropping colonies at the morning star. And imagine some figure in some undetermined time in the future who may come back to this coast. What moody traveler wanders back here will see these seabirds flying around, will see the sea granite, and will see also his tower, the cemented granite, and his ghost will still be wandering there because in his life he's been so attached to this landscape. This wandering figure then will greet his ghost that is one temper with the granite, bulking about here, a massive ghostly presence. We're concerned with a coast, with a shore, with an edge of the world. In a beautiful book called In Defense of Sensuality by the Anglo-Welsh writer John Cooper Powers, Powers evokes the pre-Socratics, these Greek philosophers, before the beginning, if you like, of, let's say, Western philosophy as such, before Plato and Socrates, the pre-Socratics. Pyrrhus describes them in the following terms. I quote, "With one foot on the sandy shore of the traditions of humanity, the other in the salt sea of our non-human cosmos." These pre-Socratics then, described by Pyrrhus as, with one foot on the sandy shore of the traditions of humanity, the other on the salt sea of our non-human cosmos. That's very much the situation of Jeffers. One foot in humanity and the other in the non-human. He's very close to these pre-Socratics, and he takes up his stand against those whom Nietzsche, who's also in his reading background, whom Nietzsche called the last men. The last men, in Nietzsche's terminology, were men with small minds, but who are massively and mechanically productive, covering the earth with their man-made constructions. With his one foot in humanity and the other in a non-human cosmos, Jeffers is, as I say, taking up his stand against these last men and taking up his stand, to a certain extent, against America, against the United States. He says of America, "America," and I quote, "settles in the mold of its vulgarity." For him, the civilization of the U.S., which was modern civilization in its last throes, I mean, America for him was only an example. His perspectives are much wider. We don't define him ever as simply anti-American. That's too simple. The American civilization as the last stage of modern Western civilization was, in his estimation, a civilization that could no longer breed a real culture. Jeffers has no faith whatsoever in linear progress. He has this cyclical conception of things. Things live, things die. He has no national idealism of any kind, and he has absolutely no cultural optimism whatsoever, which of course made him very much a stranger, very much an isolated figure within a context which was progressive, idealistic, optimistic, humanitarian, what you will. In a new Masses questionnaire that was put to him around 1920, the question was put to him, did he consider that American literature was decadent? And Jeffers says, no, American literature is not specifically decadent. It's not specifically anything at all. But he said, American civilization is beginning to be definitely decadent, and in the future, it will only become more decadent. His perspectives, as I say, are wider and larger. He says this, for example, and this is, if you like, a kind of biological standpoint. He says, we are something more than American. He's not willing to be defined in purely or simply American terms, any national terms, any civilizational terms. We are something more than American citizens and creatures of the 20th century. Our race doesn't change so rapidly as all that. Our bodies and souls are equally capable of adaptation to life in the Middle Ages or the interglacial ages. Our cells remember the salt sea of the origin and the turns of the sea tides. A biological conception of life rather than a humanistic, humanitarian conception or social conception. Our cells remember the salt sea of their origin and the turns of the sea tides. So that's the biological perspectives, if you like, the sense of life from a biological point of view rather than from a socio-human point of view. And then there are the historical perspectives. And there the book which sparked off his reflections, one of the books, was Spengler's Decline of the West, which is a study of culture morphology, the shaping and the unshaping of cultures, the growth and the decadence or the ruin of cultures. Civilizations, there have been many of them. There are several counts. Some people say 21, some people say 30. Let's say between 20 and 30 civilizations have existed in history. And there's no specific reason to think that our civilization will last or be more permanent than these others. Spengler tended to think that we were moving towards the end of a complete cycle, a cycle that you might say started in Athens and ends in America. The Athens-America cycle, if you like, the whole cycle of modern Western civilization, now almost over, reaching its death throes, if you like. Now this perspective, this idea that a culture, a civilization was reaching its end, for many was a devastating perspective, because they saw themselves inevitably wandering in a cultural desert, in a mental wasteland. But for others, harder minds if you like, this kind of perspective was exhilarating, because it meant the possibility of a bird's eye view of the whole of human civilization. It meant a kind of rapacious solitude, hence the image of the hawks, a kind of hovering freedom. Spengler's conclusions were purely pessimistic, shall we say. He said that in our age, it was useless to try and think, useless to try and create poetry. It would be better just to simply build bridges or make cars or something. But there were other minds who were unwilling to wait until a new initial time came in, who saw the possibility of a kind of, in this interim, in this end space, maybe a chance to get out of civilization's historical movement altogether, to live a kind of unedited type of existence. The individual being able to be free, at least in his own mind. This meant an extremist landscape mindscape. Let's say an extremist mindscape for which Jeffers found a correlative, an objective correlative, in the California Western landscape. It meant a kind of existence which was anachronistic, outside time, atopian, in the sense that it was outside the normal places of thought. It meant a cool lucidity. Jeffers not only felt that he was living at the end of what you might call modern Western civilization, he felt that it was maybe time to think and live the end of humanism. What's humanism in a fast definition? Well, maybe it's a quasi-exclusive interest by men in men and men's doings. Whereas for Jeffers, as for other minds of his type, there are a lot more interesting things outside men's doings. Humanism means also a belief in the human capacity to build a perfect world, or at least a better world, using the non-human world exclusively as material. Whereas Jeffers would like to have an attitude to the non-human world which is not one of pure exploitation. In other words, humanism for minds like Jeffers is limited to an all-too-human conception of life. And he put forward a philosophy of life which he called, in contradistinction to this humanism, which was tending to turn into a rundown humanitarianism, he called it inhumanism. And this was a kind of challenge, of course, for which he got hit on the head, as you imagine. Inhumanism, he defines in the following terms, a certain philosophical attitude, which might be called inhumanism, a shifting of emphasis and significance from man to not man. This manner of thought and feeling is neither misanthropic nor pessimistic. It has objective truth and human value. For many, this was a shock. It was even infamous to suggest that there should be something in an inhumanist conception of life. It shocked many people. But in an age of perhaps false sympathies, sentimentalities, and a host of what Jeffers felt to be humanitarian flummery, this inhumanism could be a source of regeneration, could be a freshening of the mind works and the life processes. It could be a source of real feeling and real thinking outside the social circus of phony habits and corny ideologies. And in fact, with this doctrine of inhumanism, Jeffers, to my mind, is in a very strong American tradition, which is personified, shall we say, by Thoreau, among others. Thoreau, who says that he does not like, and I quote, that culture which is exclusively an interaction of man and man, a sort of breeding in and in. Thoreau was against what he would have conceived of as human introversion. And I think myself that inhumanism, or let's call it inhumanism to use one word, is part and parcel of the finest humanism. The greatest humanists have been inhumanist to a certain extent. Heraclitus, for example, whom we consider as a humanist, he considered that there was a logos, there was a truth of the world, there was a meaning of the world, there was a presence of the world, which was beyond the conception of man. And his admiration tended to go more towards fire than to humanity. Think of Montaigne, another humanist. I'm running over the centuries, jumping over the centuries. Montaigne says that he prefers a philosophy that belittles humanity. And Nietzsche, to again jump over a few centuries, Nietzsche says that artistic creation, real creativity, does not come from the human ego, but has a much more fundamental source. The source of real creativity for Nietzsche comes from two principles, the Apollonian principle and the Dionysian principle. In other words, energies which are not simply human. These energies are outside the all-too-human sphere, and they alone lead in Nietzsche's aesthetics, in Nietzsche's thinking and creativity, to two things, power and beauty. Beauty offers no difficulties. Power probably does. Let's make it clear right from the beginning that when Nietzsche talks of power, he by no means intends domination. On the contrary, the man of power in Nietzsche does not need to dominate other people. And on the contrary, he is characterized by his kindness and generosity. But power and beauty are the values, and they're very much the values of Jeffers. To let go of the word inhumanism just for a moment, but keeping it in mind, here's Carlyle in his book on the heroic in history, speaking of what he calls the great silent men. He says this, the great silent men, looking round on the noisy inanity of the world, words with little meaning, actions with little worth, one loves to reflect on the great empire of silence. Those silent men, scattered here and there, each in his department, silently thinking, silently working, whom no morning newspaper makes mention of. They are the salt of the earth. So Jeffers, inhumanist, is one of these silent men. And look how he puts across his life, look how he portrays his life, look how he presents it in the poem Point Joe. Trying to get to the point, shall we say. Point Joe. Again, a place on this California coast in the region of Carmel. Point Joe has teeth and has torn ships. It has fierce and solitary beauty. Walk there all day, you shall see nothing that will not make part of a poem. I saw the spars and planks of shipwreck on the rocks, and beyond the desolate sea meadows rose the warped, wind-beaten van of the pines, a fog bank, vaulted forest and all, the flat sea meadows at that time of year were plated golden with a low flower called Footsteps of the Spring, millions of flowerets, whose light suffused upward into the fog, flooded its vault. We wandered through a weird country where the light beat up from earthward and was golden. One other moved there, an old Chinaman gathering seaweed from the sea rocks. He brought it in his basket and spread it flat to dry on the edge of the meadow. Permanent things are what is needful in a poem, things temporarily of great dimension, things continually renewed are always present. Grass that is made each year equals the mountains in our past and future. Fashionable and momentary things we need not see nor speak of. Man gleaning food between the solemn presences of land and ocean, on shores where better men have shipwrecked, under fog and among flowers, equals the mountains in his past and future. That glow from the earth was only a trick of nature's. One must forgive nature a thousand graceful subtleties. So you have this interest in permanent things as against modish, passing, merely fashionable things. And you have the figure, and this is a kind of alter ego, if you like, you have the figure of the old Chinaman. The old Chinaman going about his plain, ordinary, simple business on this coast. The old Chinaman, which reminds me of what Henry Miller, who was going to live on this coast a few years later, calls the rock bottom man. The man who's got right down to fundamentals. The human being who has got right down to fundamentals. The rock bottom man. So that's what comes across in this poem. Rock bottom man and praise of permanent things. Jeffers wrote rather long poems, partly. Part of his work consists in long narrative poems, which caused him a lot of trouble with the critics, because they were considered as being obsessively melodramatic. Obsessive, so far as human pathology is concerned, and melodramatic in their presentation. These were people poems, place poems and people poems, because Jeffers felt that the people on the coast, or this coast, bred a certain extravagance in people, a certain pathology, if you like. And he wished to portray the lives of these people, hence the poems had to be extravagant and, let's say, pathological in inverted commas. In a letter in 1926, he says this: "Someone said to me lately that it is not possible to be quite sane here. Many others feel a hostility of the region to common human life." So in these long poems, he's depicting the lives of people on the coast which are beyond the common, which are outside the pale, which are extravagant, erratic existences. And I say long poem. By long poem, I simply mean a poem which lasts for 50, 60, or 100 pages. And to speak about the pathological aspects of it, I think that one aspect of these long poems in Jeffers goes back to the ballads, the Scottish ballads. In a ballad, as you know, a ballad is a relatively short poem. I think that Jeffers sort of extended the ballad form to, you know, he blew it up 10, 20 times. But in a ballad, as you know, within about 20 lines, you can easily have three murders, a rape, and a couple of suicides. I mean, that just happens normally. Another aspect of these long poems, which are very much tragedies, they have their origin in his awareness of Greek tragedy. They're the depiction of tragic lives, attempting to see a life burning itself down to the essential, a life really burning itself till what remains is sheer white bone. Another origin, I think, of these poems is the interest that Jeffers had, like other modern poets, in certain practices of primitive peoples, ceremonial dances, for example. The poem is a kind of ceremonial dance. And yet another influence, I think, is the Japanese no play. A Japanese no play, which is a long dramatic poem having its basis in the return to a certain landscape full of ghosts of a wandering solitary figure. Now, why did he write these long poems, which, as I say, were mostly badly received by the critics and found extremely indigestible by the public? Well, there was, first of all, that he felt the need to exorcise the demonic energy of the place he was living in. It was a kind of exorcisation. He wished, if you like, to also, I think, maybe to protect his own sanity. By writing about other people going insane, if you like, going mad, he was protecting his own sanity. And then there's a third reason. I think this is the most interesting reason that I would propose, at least. And I get the idea from a phrase of Nietzsche's, who says this: "Do you wish to become a universal I? For that, you will have to pass through many individualities, with the last using the others as function. Do you wish to become a universal I? For that, you will have to pass through many individualities, with the last using the others as functions." And I think that Jeffreys wished to become a universal I. Therefore, he had to pass through several existences. And these people he is portraying in these long poems, if you like, are sort of alter egos whose existences he is living through in order to achieve in his own life a universal I. These figures mostly are engaged in a breakdown of their lives, a breakdown of their mentalities. But a breakdown can be a breakthrough. And they are breaking through into an unconditioned state of being. They're burning their conditioned life, they're breaking up their conditioned life in order to pierce through to an unconditioned state of being. They're breaking out of the human condition with the possibility on the horizon of walking in a clear dawn, becoming clear walker. And this cleansing process, this cathartic process, this deconditioning process is what comes across, I think, in the poem November Surf. November Surf, the ocean coming up against the coast, cleaning it, scouring it. November Surf. Some lucky day, each November, great waves awake and are drawn like smoking mountains bright from the west, and come and cover the cliff with white, violent cleanness. Then suddenly the old granite forgets half a year's filth, the orange peel, eggshells, papers, pieces of clothing, the clots of dung and corners of the rock and used sheaths that make light love safe in the evenings, all the droppings of the summer idlers washed off in a winter ecstasy. I think this cumbered continent envies its cliff then, but all seasons the earth in her childlike prophetic sleep keeps dreaming of the bath of a storm that prepares up the long coast of the future to scour more than her sea lines. The cities going down, the people fewer, and the hawks more numerous. The river's mouth to source pure, when a two-footed mammal, being some ways one of the nobler animals, regains the dignity of room, the value of rareness. The language, I think, is limpid, simple, and clear, and needs, I think, no commentary, no explanation to make it clear. This need of a cleansing force, a cleaning force to come in against all the encumbrances, all the accumulated filth on the coast, on a culture, on a human being's life. To come to the idea of the universal I. In Chinese culture, in Chinese Taoism, the philosophy of the way, the life of the way, the name for a Taoist monastery, a place of isolation, concentration, contemplation, is written with two ideograms, two Chinese ideograms, one portraying a bird and the other an eye. In other words, in the beginning, the Taoist monastery was, shall we say, an observation tower for the study of nature or for the attention to cosmic signs. And I tend to look at Jeffreys Tower on the west coast, on the California coast, in terms of this Taoist monastery, a bird and an eye. His birds are gulls, cormorants, hawks, and he is, in his mind, trying to achieve this universal I. His tower, Jeffreys Tower, I see then as ontologically rooted and rising up into a cool space, a cool mental existential space beyond tragedy, the tower beyond tragedy. His philosophy, if I had to define it, I would say that it's an organic cosmology. Organic cosmology, that's the wide global perspective. And in within that large framework, there is phenomenology, shall we say, or let's say a phenomenal world. Let's not make it a logy, let's keep the sense of world. A phenomenal world then within an organic cosmology. And within that phenomenal world, a human being walking, trying to achieve clarity, simplicity, a certain absoluteness of being. Spirits and illusions have died, says Jefferson in the poem. Spirits and illusions have died. The naked mind lives in the beauty of inanimate things. Spirits and illusions have died. The naked mind lives in the beauty of inanimate things. So you have then this naked mind walking the coast, gazing at the phenomenal world and glimpsing momentary perceptions of some even deeper reality. As in this poem, Grey Weather. Grey Weather. It is true that older than man and ages to outlast him, the Pacific surf still cheerfully pounds the worn drum, granite drum. But there's no storm, and the birds are still no song, no kind of excess, nothing that shines, nothing is dark. There is neither joy, nor grief, nor a person. The sun's tooth sheathed in cloud, and life has no more desires than a stone. The stormy conditions of time and change are all abroad. The essential violences of survival, pleasure, love, wrath, and pain, and the curious desire of knowing, all perfectly suspended in the cloudy light, in the timeless quietness. One explores deeper than the nerves of heart of nature, the womb or soul, to the bone, the careless white bone, the excellence. The Pacific surf pounding away in its drum there like some old shaman. This fundamental music, and within this fundamental music, an absolute perception. There is, I think, a terrible splendor in Jeffers' writing, terrible splendor. I'm thinking of Yeats's poem concerning the terrible beauty. There's a terrible splendor in this writing, in these lines, and if you like, what I would call a barbarian beauty. Some obvious faults. There is a certain amount of melodramatization. Sometimes the psychological portrayals are a bit heavy-footed. And there is, let's face it, let's admit it, quite a lot of overwriting. But that takes nothing away from this space, this power, this cosmological presence that you have in this poetry. For long, he was an isolated figure. For obvious reasons, which we've gone into in part, he was not considered persona grata by certain elements of the critical establishment. He is no poet for pernickety textual analysis, as was the habit in the so-called New Criticism at the beginning of the century. His poems, so far as language is concerned, are limpid, clear, forceful and powerful, leaving no room for, as I say, textual analysis. His inhumanism also went against the grain and put him beyond the pale. He was ostracized for his thinking. And of course also his distance from idealism and ideology. He said, "I can lie in prose," but in poetry he wanted to tell only the truth of existence. In a sense, you might say that Jeffers' place and his space are not literary space. He is not literary, you know, in the sort of narrow sense of the word. His place and space are, first of all, that coast, that continental coast, that Californian coast, full of what he calls bitter wonders, bitter wonders. His place and space is the Pacific Ocean, which he tends to see as the eye of the earth, never closing, an eye that has seen struggles greater than human struggles. It's a space of informal energies and wild, savage lights. A space which I would like to call cosmopoetic rather than literary. And that's what comes across, I think, in this final poem I'd like to look at, this cosmopoetic space rather than a literary space, is dissatisfaction with mere literature, shall we say, or with too much literature, and a desire to renew perception, sensation, existence of a world or a human life in the world. That's what comes across in this poem, Love the Wild Swan. Love the Wild Swan. I hate my verses, every line, every word. Oh, pale and brittle pencils, ever to try one grass blade's curve, or the throat of one bird that clings to twig, ruffled against white sky. Oh, cracked and twilight mirrors, ever to catch one color, one glinting flash of the splendor of things. Unlucky hunter, oh, bullets of wax, the lion duty, the wild swan wings, the storm of the wings. This wild swan of a world is no hunter's game. Better bullets than yours would miss the white breast. Better mirrors than yours would crack in the flame. Does it matter whether you hate yourself? At least love your eyes that can see, your mind that can hear the music, the thunder of the wings. Love the wild swan. What counts then is eyes that can see, and a mind that can hear the music of the world, the music of the cosmos, the thunder of the wings. Love the wild swan. Okay, merci. Terminé pour aujourd'hui.